It's often claimed that all scientists of any standing believe in the theory of evolution. I know the majority do, but I'm quite sure most of them were taught evolution as fact, and most of them have never heard the facts against evolution. They were educated to evolution, so they go along with it. On the other hand, many good scientists reject evolution. For example, in America, in one organization, the Creation Research Society, there are over 600 highly qualified scientists holding advanced degrees of master or PhD who are pledged against evolution and for the biblical account of creation and Noah's deluge. And for example, in South Korea, there's a new group of 300 scientists, the majority of them hold those advanced degrees of master or PhD, and all of them reject evolution. And around the world, there are hundreds of other good scientists who reject evolution but who have to remain silent for fear of losing their careers. Lately, in America, more than 50% of science graduates are rejecting evolution. Believe me, you can reject evolution and be in good company. The big question is, how did it all begin? Earth and universe, life, animals and man. It had to be either by creation or by evolution. One or the other. There's no valid third choice. But evolution or creation, does it matter anyway? It matters so much. The future of our civilization depends on the answer. Our 20th century world is engulfed in the greatest spiritual war of all time. A world revolution to bring a new world order in which the Christian God will have no place. In the vanguard are Marxist communism, secular humanism, and the New Age movement. All of them are implacable enemies of the Christian God, and all of them have their roots in the theory of evolution. They have great power and influence in the world, and they're using evolution as their main tool for cutting down the Creator God. You see, you can't take God out of the mind of man unless you offer a substitute for God. And that's where Darwin was useful. Darwin offered the only substitute for God, evolution. The general theory of evolution, as taught in many schools, is godless. And evolution education is largely responsible for our 20th century godlessness. It has to be understood that Christianity is a religion of redemption from original sin. Without original sin, Christianity has no meaning. So the simplest way to bring down Christianity is to strike down original sin. And to do that, you simply abolish Adam. Evolution abolishes Adam and gives us the ape men. That's why evolution is the perfect tool to kill Christianity and the Christian God, and to bring down the Christian civilization. Catholic listeners should know that in 1950, Pope Pius XII's encyclical, Humani Generis, warned of the dangers of extreme evolutionism. It stipulated, among other things, that when evolution is being considered, the facts against evolution must be given full consideration too. Well, maybe this tape will help Catholic teachers and students and parents to obey that stipulation. And I hope it will help listeners of any denomination to get the facts balanced. We start with the second law of thermodynamics. The most fatal objection to the theory of evolution is that it goes against the second law of thermodynamics. We observe that the universe is running down, that all natural systems are degenerating from orderliness to disorderliness. This is so universally recognized that science defines it as the second law of thermodynamics, and nothing breaks this law. The law can be stated in various ways. For our purposes, it means, 1. Natural processes, if left to themselves, always move towards disorder. And 2. The simple will not produce the more complex. But evolution requires the opposite. It requires disorder to turn into order. It requires simple hydrogen gas to evolve into the universe and then on into animals and man. Evolutionists try to get around the second law this way. They claim that the Earth is an open system, open to the sun's energy. They claim that raw energy from the sun allows life to begin and evolution to proceed. This claim is untenable. The second law applies to open systems as much as it applies to closed systems. The fact is, almost all systems are open to the sun's energy, but most do not become alive or grow. Besides, the sun's energy falls on the moon and on Mars, where nothing has ever stirred to life. Life requires something special. Life requires, first, an intelligence to plan and direct the sun's energy, and second, a mechanism for converting that energy as the plan directs. In fact, life requires the intelligence of a DNA blueprint and the photosynthesis mechanism. And these are so superhumanly intricate, they require a superhuman intelligence to design them. Don't let anyone tell you that evolution doesn't break the unbreakable second law. Darwin's evolution suited the mood of the 19th century, seeking an escape from God. And Darwin's theory rapidly spread, his theory that chance variations were preserved and accumulated by natural selection. Later, the modern science of genetics revealed that microscopic genes, G-E-N-E-S, in the living cell control the variations of individuals, but within the limits of the species or kind. The genes of a cockroach or a kangaroo or a man carry the blueprint which determines the appearance and the character of the cockroach, the kangaroo, and the man. The blueprint allows variations within the kind, but no further. So cockroaches produce baby cockroaches, kangaroos produce baby kangaroos, and one kind does not jump the barrier into a different kind. However, the neo-Darwinists claim that mutations of genes will change a species into a new species over long time. But what is a mutation? A mutation is a mistake in the gene's blueprint, whereby an offspring is produced with an abnormality which becomes inheritable. Mutations are rare, and their misfortunes. They cause diabetes, hemophilia, sickle cell anemia, flies without wings, and all sorts of deformities. The very word mutant has a sense of doom. Yet, neo-Darwinists say that mutations are the mechanism of evolution. Why? The reason is simply they have nothing else. Now, there is no known beneficial mutation, yet these Darwinists claim that maybe one mutation in 1,000, or even one in 10,000, will be beneficial and will eventually turn a jellyfish into a Shakespeare. Now, don't let's forget this basic point. Any upward step in complexity requires an increase in the information which is coded in the DNA blueprint. Mutations never add to the information. They simply disturb the existing information. We pass on to the fossil record. If living things started from a microscopic cell 3 billion years ago and evolved upward step by step into the complex variety of living creatures, if this happened, they would have lived and died and been fossilized millions and billions and trillions of intermediate creatures, steadily bridging the transition from one kind to the next kind. But where are those half-and-half creatures? There should be many more fossils of intermediates than fossils of the perfected species, but there's not one. No fossil has ever been found of an intermediate experimental creature. What the fossil record does show is this: perfected kinds and unbridged gaps separating the kinds. Actually, the fossil record is beautiful evidence for genesis, creatures created according to their kind. Later, I'll be challenging the geologic column and its billion-year time spans But for the moment, let's go along with them while we look at the fossil record through evolutionist eyes. According to the fossils in the rocks, there was an explosion of life in the Cambrian period 600 million years ago. The rocks older than the Cambrian show scarcely any record of life. In the Precambrian rocks, there are traces of single-cell life, but there's nothing, not one fossil, of something evolving into the complex creatures that suddenly appear in the Cambrian. Now, evolution requires a great Precambrian fossil record, from single cells up to complex creatures, and it's not there. Except for those traces of single cells, the Precambrian rocks are barren and lifeless. But in the Cambrian rocks, immediately above them, the fossils appear suddenly. Suddenly there's teeming life, and these are highly complex and specialized creatures, sharply divided into species, genera, families, and the rest. Even Darwin admitted that the first fossils could be an objection to his theory. Another scientist proclaimed, "The rocks cry out creation." After the Cambrian period, new groups and kinds appear in the rocks from time to time. But every time a new kind appears, it appears suddenly, fully perfect, and with no link to any previous kind. The fossil record contradicts evolution. We turn from the dead fossil world to the living world around us, and we find that living creatures prove that species and kinds do not change, no matter how great the time span. Take the turtles. They've been turtles forever. There are no quarter turtles, no half turtles. The very first turtles were perfect turtles. There's a dragonfly still with us after 60 million years. The lungfish hasn't changed in 220 million years. Spiders unchanged after 300 million years. Cockroaches and silverfish the same after 350 million years. The jellyfish was the same jellyfish 550 million years ago. Blue-green algae was the same 900 million years ago. If any creature living today appears also in the fossil record, its fossil form is similar to its present form. Now, did a reptile become a bird? The extinct bird Archaeopteryx was put forward as a link between reptile and bird. But two of today's leading evolutionists, Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge, have stated that Archaeopteryx is not a transitional form, but is a mosaic, a curious mosaic like the duck-billed platypus. Anyway, a recent find seems to remove Archaeopteryx from the argument. Paleontologist James Jensen has found what he believes to be fossil bones of modern birds in rocks of the same period as Archaeopteryx. You know, evolutionists believe on pure faith, without any evidence, that reptiles turned into birds, in spite of the immense changes that would be necessary, including scales turning into feathers which are a miracle of natural engineering. How could a reptile's scales turn into wonderful feathers? Evolutionists claim that friction of air did it. Friction of air on the scales of generations of reptiles as they jumped from tree to ground, or as they ran along the ground waving their forelimbs in the air. Friction of air over vast time, fraying scales into wonderful feathers. Well, what do you think? Douglas Dewar, fellow of the Zoological Society, said, "If this is serious science, then so is the story of Cinderella." Now the prize exhibit, the horse, the evolution of the horse. Leading evolutionists know that the horse series is in trouble. The great weakness of the horse series is that there is no generic connection between one specimen and the next. At the bottom of the horse series, you'll find little Eohippus, the dawn horse, also called Hyracotherium. Eohippus doesn't look anything like a horse. He's about the size of a large rabbit, with four toes on front feet and three toes on hind feet. His skeleton is identical to that of a little animal that's running around Africa today, the hyrax, sometimes called the dayman. It seems that the dawn horse is really a shy little rabbit-like animal that's still running around Africa today. Another weakness of the series is this. Eohippus has 18 pairs of ribs, the next specimen has 19, then there's a jump backwards to 15, and finally up again to 18 pairs of ribs for Equus, the modern horse. And again, nowhere in the world are the fossils of the horse series found in successive strata. Often they're not even in the same continent. And yet again, in Oregon, USA, you'll find the three-toed specimen and the one-toed specimen in the same strata. And even worse than that, in South America, the modern one-toed specimen is found below the primitive three-toed specimen. It should be the other way around. And to cap the lot, fossils of the dawn horse have been found in surface strata alongside two types of modern horse. Really, the horse series has fallen apart. Yet, the average person is encouraged to believe that this is the great evidence for evolution. In 1980, there was a dramatic development which changed the whole debate. But first, let me mention the hopeful monster. In 1940, an eminent geneticist, Richard Goldsmith, realized that there are no fossils of intermediate creatures and that evolution could not have happened by gradual steps. So he proposed that evolution must have happened by big jumps. He proposed that from time to time, monsters must have been born, which survived and bred and started a new species. He even agreed that a reptile may have laid an egg and a bird hatched out. The neo-Darwinists laughed at Goldsmith's theory of hopeful monsters. They laughed at it for 40 years. Then in 1980, they stopped laughing. They finally had to admit, like Goldsmith did, that there are no fossils of transitional creatures. In October 1980, there was an important conference in Chicago. At this conference, 160 leading evolutionists virtually pronounced the death of Darwinism. These experts admitted that there are no fossil links between one species and another. Newsweek reported, 3rd of November 1980, quote, "Evidence from the fossil record now points overwhelmingingly away from the classical Darwinism which most Americans learned in high school," unquote. Well, nobody said, "Sorry, we've been teaching error for a century." No, all that seemed to matter was that they had to find a substitute for Darwinism to keep evolution going. They came up with punctuated equilibria, which is evolution by big jumps, shades of the hopeful monster. They said there must have been long periods of stability, equilibrium, punctuated by periods of rapid change into new species. Changes so rapid, they left no intermediate fossils. Now, it's a variation of Goldsmith's ideas, and Goldsmith is respectable again. Punctuated equilibrium shows that evolution is in deep crisis. It must be the only scientific theory ever devised to fit missing evidence. Punctuated equilibrium is anti-science. It goes against all known genetic science. Well, that ends the first section.